thank you that you have moved among men and women of various ethnic backgrounds, various temperaments, used various people in the history of your church. We ask and pray that your grace would be poured on us tonight as we look and examine a crucial period in the history of our own nation and try to understand how it still impacts us today. For in Christ's name we pray. Amen. Here's the game plan for tonight. We are going to briefly, and I mean briefly, less than probably 5 minutes or less, finish up a few things that were on the last notes about Native Americans and missions among African slaves, African American slaves. And I'm just, because we've already touched a little bit on it, and we will, in a sense, come back to it briefly when we talk about the Great Awakening, both first and second, but I just wanted to just have a little separate time to talk about them. And then we are going to get into the Great Awakening, the first one. And this is a crucial period in American religious history, history of American Christianity, and it's a period of great revival, but it's also a period that is interesting to learn what the Great Awakening was really like, because sometimes we tend to have romanticized notions about what a period of great revival would be like. And like all historians, historians love to debunk romanticized notions. And so we will debunk some romanticized notions about the Great Awakening this evening. We will talk about it as a genuine work of God, but we will also talk about some of the things that happened in connection with the first Great Awakening. The other thing is I've got three links up here, and I can tell you briefly, if you don't want to spend the time copying down all these links, these are all videos of the best modern example that I can give you of the kind of preaching that a 17th century Puritan or an 18th century revivalist such as Jonathan Edwards would have done. And it's by Dr. John Gerstner, who some of you know was R.C. Sproul's mentor. It's his famous exposition of the parable of the wise and foolish virgins in Matthew 25. And if you can only watch one of them, watch the last one, because he summarizes briefly. And I guarantee you, if you're like most modern evangelicals, you probably will watch them and get done not sure that you're really a Christian. Because that's the response virtually everybody has to these. Because he goes through the wise and foolish virgins and shows you all the reasons of the things we oftentimes say are the proofs that I'm really a Christian. And he says they're not really good proofs. They may be, but they aren't necessarily proofs that you're genuinely a Christian. And so when we've talked about the conversion narratives that people had to give, the dramatic conversion, this is the kind of preaching that they... Now, he's not... Dr. Gerstner is one of the... had a chance to study with him as well, because he was semi-retired, and he came to our seminary as a visiting professor while I was in seminary. He visited in our home. I have to say he's the most intense man that I've ever met in my life. You'll see his intensity. He's not a fiery kind of speaker, but he's intense. And he'll say, "Oh, foolish virgins," like that throughout there, you know. And you'll get the point. You'll get the point. And he will have you thinking after a while. As I said, almost every evangelical Christian I've ever had seen these things will say, oh boy, am I really a Christian after I watch these? But the reason I'm giving you those is because if any of you have been wondering, what was this, the different style of preaching? This is a good example. Each one is 30 minutes. If you want the quick way, just look up John Gerstner, G-E-R-S-T-N-E-R, Parable of the Wise and Foolish Virgins. They'll pop right up in your Google search, and you won't have to copy all these little scribble marks down. I always find those irritating because you get one out of the order and you can't possibly get it right. But they will give you an example. And if you really want to have your soul searched, watch all 90 minutes of them. But this will give you some idea. And the difference, of course, as we will see, between the Puritan preaching was less, while it was driving for a dramatic conversion, it was less fiery. The preaching in the First Great Awakening, as we will see, was fiery. But the goal was the same, to get you, to challenge you, to say, the things that I normally would look for as signs of conversion aren't necessarily signs of conversion. And that's what Gerstner is doing in there. than us. He supposedly, first time we heard R.C. Sproul, Jenny and I at a conference, we looked at each other and we said, Gerstner with a sense of humor. Because that's what R.C. Sproul is. John Gerstner has no sense of humor. Not a whiff. And he supposedly said to R.C. one time, he says, yeah, he says, you're like me, only you got a good sense of humor. And people don't get bothered by you like they do by me or something like that. So if you've seen a lot of R.C. Sproul, and I know a number of you have, you will recognize the similarities. But you'll also see some of the intensity of John Gerstner. So that's what those are all about. So tonight, Richard, we can go back to the other, to our PowerPoint here. We're picking up briefly, just a couple of minutes, the last end where we're going to talk about Native American missions and missions to the African American slaves. Because we want to just tie up a couple of loose ends before we look at the Great Awakening. We're going to zip through some of these quickly and get to the end of this. Missions to Native Americans. We have a couple of people there who did missions to Native Americans in particular, but they weren't the only ones. But these are a couple of the most prominent in the early colonial days, John Eliot and Thomas Mayhew, who made significant attempts to evangelize Native American Indians. Eliot, as I said before, translated the Bible into the Algonquian language. You might say, what's the Algonquian? That was the language spoken by the majority of the New England tribes, the Algonquian language, like the Abenakis and the Delawares, the Shawnee. A lot of these tribes spoke a version of the Algonquian language. And so he translated the Bible, first Bible printed in the New World. We've mentioned King Philip's War before. It was actually did a lot of undoing of these praying towns, or praying villages, as they were called. And most of the converts were viewed with suspicion, were quarantined in Boston Harbor. The closest modern analogy I could think of is the Japanese internment camps during World War II. I mean, most of us are familiar, have heard about that. That's what they put them equivalent, the converts in, which of course made the Native American converts immediately think they don't trust us too much, which they didn't, because there were a few who reneged on their conversion and joined in King Philip's War. All it took was a handful to do that, and what you'll quickly notice is a significant number of people start questioning the legitimacy their conversion. The Puritan missionaries clearly had a model that they should be educated, basically made into full-blown Englishmen and women to be seen as genuine converts. Don't look to the writings of this time to see positive statements about Native American culture, because you won't find any. All you will find are comments about the barbaric, savage culture that they came out of. There was no modern, let's look at multiculturalism and see this is a wonderful thing. They clearly looked at the culture was tainted by the false beliefs. Many of the Native American missionaries to the Native Americans were very much bothered by the lack of immediate response. They're hanging on to Indian ways, and this led to a very tense isn't probably the right word, but ambiguous approach by the Puritan missionaries. And they clearly were serious. David Brainerd basically poured out his life. He died young of tuberculosis, but he poured out his life in missions to them. And he was married to one of Jonathan Edwards' daughters. And so there were serious, serious attempts, but there was this very ambiguous relationship about the converts. And in the long run, only a handful remained loyal to the initial New England attempts at missions. The Moravians had greater success. Moravian missionaries such as David Zeisberger, who lived from 1721 to 1808. You can write his name on the board for you if you'd like to see it. Good German name, because the Moravians were from a German background. David Zeisberger. He was one who worked tirelessly and gained many converts. But one of the things that we will see is that the Moravians took a different model, and they had some success with this. But among their model was less concern with trying to change their culture, But there was also the Moravians, and this is where the more Puritan background missionaries didn't like the Moravians, because they thought the Moravians taught a form of easy believism. All you had to say was, I love Jesus, and they were ready to stamp convert on you and baptize you and say you're one of us. And many of the Puritan missionaries said, how easy isn't it to say I love Jesus? And they have no clue. And some of the later Baptist and Presbyterian missionaries who spent time with them would inquire of some of the converts of the Moravians, and they would say they know nothing about the faith. Yeah, they can say the words I love Jesus, but they knew nothing about the faith. Now, Zinzendorf and the Moravians did some wonderful great things, but this is one of those areas where maybe they've been challenged with a kind of superficial conversion, shall we say, was what was claimed. We obviously can't read the hearts of these Indian converts. My personal guess is if the Puritans wanted theirs, as J.I. Packer said, pre-sanctified, they wanted all their converts pre-sanctified, the Moravians probably were prone to easy believism, a superficial. And the truth probably lied somewhere in the middle, but that's the reality. And there was a tension between these two approaches to missionary. Now, the Moravian converts did not always have an easy time. Because when the French and Indian War came, our friends, the Scots-Irish frontiersmen, the ancestors of some of you out here, did not particularly like Indians, and nor did they really care whether some of the Moravian Indians had a Christian cross someplace in their village. They tended to take the old West model, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And several of these Moravian Indian villages were ravaged. And in 1782, many of them who had moved out to Ohio were actually clubbed to death by marauding bands of backwoods, mostly from Scots-Irish background frontiersmen, who took that approach, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And so they suffered. They were constantly pushed forward by white settlers. Some eventually moved into upstate New York and Ontario, with some remnants of them today. There were some other missions to Indians with Jonathan Edwards, as we will learn, the great preacher, spent the end of his career before he became the president of Princeton, what they called it the College of New Jersey, but it would be today Princeton University. Interesting, he went from being a successful pastor to getting booted out of his congregation, we'll tell you more about that later, to becoming an Indian missionary, to becoming president of one of the premier colleges in America. How about that for a quick change of movement? But he did. And there are still descendants of some of his missions that live and have moved to northern Wisconsin. And my presbytery has some churches up there. And we would always kind of laugh every time they called a new pastor. This is up in the woods, northwest of Green Bay, Wisconsin. They're in the bounds of the presbytery I belong to. The pastor's call always would get four deer in your every winter, because you have to put the terms of your call, eight cords of firewood, and all kinds of other interests, because they live out in these backwoods kind of area. And we would have elders who were from these churches and came to our presbytery meetings. So there are still descendants of Jonathan Edwards the Indians, who are now in the upper Midwest. And so there was some success, obviously, because these are some devout, serious Christians. But it was always a mixed bag. The next quick group we will quickly talk about are the slaves. We know slavery first came over. They were slow to adopt Christianity, partially because many of the slave owners were well aware of the implications of slave conversions. And they knew that if a slave was converted, that put him on a spiritual equality with their white owners. And they resisted attempts by missionaries, and there were a number of them, to have missions to the black slaves. There were some protests by Quakers and some Mennonites. But gradually, what sold, if you will, the idea that you should send missions to slaves was when they convinced enough of the slave owners that it made them better slaves if they were converted to Christianity. Then they would allow them to do mission work if this made them better slaves. In other words, they would love to read the passages out of Paul's epistles that say slaves obey your masters, which clearly are there. And then once they figured out that they could do that, then they will more welcome them in. What we discover is that, though, it wasn't until the First Great Awakening that any significant number of African Americans, particularly slaves, would be converted to the Christian faith. The really big push will come in the Second Great Awakening after 1800, in the 1820s. But the First Great Awakening is the first large-scale numbers. It's always an interesting mixed bag, because Whitfield preached, the great evangelist, preached very strongly to slaves, but he was a slave owner himself. And he used them to run his orphanage in Bethpage, Georgia. He used slave labor to help pay for the orphanage. So everything is a mixed bag. It's hard to find good guys and bad guys in that situation, because it's a mixed bag. And it would mean that you will have to wait to learn more about that. So let's look at a summary of colonial America. Many attempts at reproducing the established European situations, most of which ultimately proved impossible to do in the American situation. There was still a lot of folk religion that persisted, especially on the edges of society. I've already hinted at that. By folk religion, I'm talking about belief in magic potions, rabbit's feet, you know, all kinds of interesting sorts of things. And that stuff persisted, as I think I mentioned before. Joseph Smith's family had a long history of being people who dabbled, the founder of Mormonism, dabbled in that sort of stuff. There were almanacs and horoscopes that got illegally published. So we need to be careful that we don't impose upon colonial America this picture of a pristine, godly society where everyone is a Bible-believing Christian. No, we have lots of materials that show there's a lot of strange stuff that goes on the fringes. But let's look at the statistics, what we have. In 1740, we had 423 congregational churches, 246 Anglican. If we know our geography, we know the Congregationalists are almost all up in New England. The Anglicans are mostly in the middle and southern colonies. But we have 160 Presbyterians, 96 Baptists, 95 Lutherans, 78 Dutch Reform, 51 German Reform, with a smattering of Mennonites, a few Roman Catholics, and other small groups, the River Brethren that I talked about last week, and other groups are there. New York City was a polyglot and would signal, along with Pennsylvania, the future of American religious life. So that's our quick survey of finishing up of colonial America pre-Great Awakening. Now, if we can, Richard, have the next slide up. While he's getting a set of PowerPoint, let me talk about the Great Awakening. What is it? The Great Awakening was a major spiritual revival. In the 1720s, really starts in the 1730s. It's at its peak between the 1740 and 1760, but in some places continues all the way through the American Revolution. So it's about a 40-year period in which there's great religious stirring in America. It changes the religious landscape of the American colonies tremendously. Now, that being said, as you may guess, historians have worked strongly on the topic of the Great Awakening. By the way, if you want a book, the best book on that is by a Baptist historian named Thomas Kidd, K-I-D-D, teaches at Baylor. He's one of our premier American religious historians. He's an evangelical Southern Baptist in his own religious persuasion, and he's an incredibly fine writer. I can't say enough good things about him, because he reads so smoothly. And he reads well, and he doesn't use a lot of words that people won't understand and that sort of thing. He is really a good writer. And his book on the Great Awakening is one of the best things I've seen. But one of the debates is, was there a Great Awakening, or was there a series of small, tangentially connected awakenings? And then some historians went back later and invented this overarching category and called it the Great Awakening. Now, Dr. Kidd, I think, absolutely correctly says, yes, we can call this whole thing the Great Awakening, as long as we realize that it takes slightly different manifestations in different places, and it'll sort of sputter out in one place, and then it moves another and moves to another place. So this is where this movement of Great Awakening is a religious revival. But let's look at a little bit of the background here. Population increase is clear in the American colonies. The population increased fourfold in New England and fivefold in the Mid-Atlantic and the Southern states between the founding in the 1630s to about 1700 when the various colonies were founded till the time of the 1730s and 40s when the Great Awakening breaks out. So that means we've got strains on the existing churches, but we also have opportunities. Strains and opportunities. The Great Awakening will come into that. Now, two examples, and one in particular that's so important, are Solomon Stoddard. Solomon Stoddard was a minister in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is in western Massachusetts in the Connecticut River Valley, just south of, right not far from where Springfield is. It's actually in the area where the University of Massachusetts is today. He lived from 1643 to 1729. Cotton Mather would be another important example, but he disagreed with Stoddard on some things. Stoddard pastored for 57 years in Northampton. He also was Jonathan Edwards' grandfather. And so this will be an important connection because Jonathan Edwards will eventually come and take over as an associate pastor for a few years and then take over as the sole pastor of his grandfather's church. Stoddard experienced five what he called harvests of souls during that time and showed that even though we start the Great Awakening per se in the 1730s, there had been times of revival before that. But what would be interesting about Stoddard was he took a different tack from the famous halfway covenant. Remember, just refresh ourselves what the halfway covenant was. This was the idea that you had a situation where you had people who couldn't profess to have been converted, but they could profess the Christian faith in an outward way, and they could be halfway members and could have their children baptized. Well, Stoddard pushed against that in an unusual sort of way. He basically said, rather than keeping the Lord's Supper from those people, which is what traditionally they had done, to come to the Lord's Supper would oftentimes be a small minority of any of these congregations. Those were the people who had experienced conversion. Stoddard said, let's look instead at the Lord's Supper as a what he called converting ordinance. In other words, as you took the Lord's Supper, God would use the Lord's Supper to bring you conversion. I'm sure that's a different model of the Lord's Supper than most of us have ever had. But it was Stoddard's model. And he claimed that the Lord was blessing it and using it to bring conversion to, he said, five harvests of people, of souls. Now, as you may guess, there were those who opposed this. Cotton Mather opposed this. Mather himself could be an overbearing, moralistic, self-promoting. He had 469 of his sermons published. For example, that's usually a sign that someone who likes to see their name in print. But he was very pious. And he was a champion of the sort of stock New England way, as you would call it, which included the halfway covenant. He was also somebody who corresponded with the Royal Society and was a vigorous promoter of science in his own way. He wrote a book called The Christian Philosopher, which was a major treatise on the harmony of science and religion. He was a convinced supernaturalist, and he tried to squelch the hysteria at Salem Village. But both Mather and Stoddard were trying to struggle with the problem of decline. Remember we talked about the Jeremiad, the declension, that from the perspective about in the early 18th century, both Mather and Stoddard would have said New England life had declined in the last 70 years. Now, Stoddard's innovation, the Lord's Supper is a converting ordinance, he said brought harvest of souls, five of them, he said. Significant numbers, hundreds would be converted in every one of those. His church grew. Mather said, no, we have to stick with the old way, but both were looking were supernaturalists, they were Calvinists in their theology, they were looking for God to pour out his spirit. But there are other factors as well. I say doctrinal laxity among the Anglicans. This is the first time that I've mentioned this. This will become something that we will be talking about for the rest of our time. The increase and infiltration of enlightenment ideas. Let me just write that term if you're not familiar with enlightenment. This would be in the period of the early Enlightenment, when these ideas are first coming in. The Enlightenment was a intellectual movement that got started in England, and then it moved to Scotland and moved to France. But it was basically the idea that all of human life is defined by human reason as the primary judge of all things. And this is very much set opposed to the traditional Christian understanding that the scriptures are your final authority for all things. The Enlightenment said human reason is. Now, what that will mean is not that everybody became an atheist overnight. What it will mean is that many people would have their Christianity tinged by Enlightenment ideas. In other words, well, some ideas don't quite seem, traditional ideas don't seem quite so logical as I once thought. So let me just trim a little bit off here. Let me trim a little bit off here. Now, when it really ran full bore and still claimed to be Christian, you ended up with Unitarianism. Because if the one thing that you clearly start to see is the Christian doctrine of the Trinity, if you start tinkering with that and pull it out of its biblical context and start talking about logic, you can easily end up in Unitarianism and say, well, one God? What's this? And they would say things like mumbo jumbo about one God existing in three persons. Now, not everybody ended up in Unitarianism, though. Many still retained the doctrine of the Trinity, but they would nibble at things like original sin and other things, doctrines like that, the role of the Holy Spirit in conversion, and they would turn Christianity into a moralistic set of rules to obey rather than a redemptive religion. Anglicanism would be heavily tinged with this starting in about 1700 through about 1730. Now, you have to remember, the Anglicans are trying to make inroads into the American colonies. The first generations or two of Anglican missionaries come over are fully Orthodox. Some of them are more high church, some of them are more Puritan oriented, what we would today call evangelical Anglicans. Starting around 1700, we start getting Anglican ministers who are tinged with this Enlightenment sort of idea. And what they start doing is appealing to the people who like this kind of idea among the population here. Let's have a religion which is reasonable. Reasonable religion was always their cry. We can't have all these doctrines of original sin and regeneration and all this stuff about supernatural conversions. Well, we got to have a reasonable religion where let's us all do good and avoid evil and believe that Jesus is, they wouldn't say he's just a good teacher, but they would have emphasized that. Jesus is primarily a moral example for us. All right? Another term that would be used for this among Anglican circles is latitudinarian. That's a hard one for me to say. But when you hear people talk about latitudinarian Anglicans, that's what they're talking about. Well, everybody's just Christians here. Just all of us here. That sort of stuff. Because as long as you are leading a basic moral life defined that sort of resembles traditional Christianity, all of us here ought to consider ourselves just good Christians. Now, if some of this rings true to the experience some of you have had with some people or maybe even in some churches, that's because this stuff has never gone away. It's around still in lots of places, and it's around in a lot of churches. Even some whole denominations have been captured by this model. We call it liberal Christianity today. But this is not new. It was already in the 1720s percolating heavily, and many of the Anglican missionaries who came over were heavily tinged by it. We also have the lure of the frontier. We have lots of people moving out to the frontier. Well, the one thing you know is when people are moving out to the frontier, what do the churches have to do? You've got to follow them. Otherwise, you're going to have whole generations. I mean, there are some people that really moved to the frontier to get away from the churches. I mean, during the Second Great Awakening, when the Methodists were so involved, there was one guy quoted, he said, "Man, I moved so far away, I didn't think anybody could find me. And lo and behold, the Methodist circuit rider found me out here." You know, how do those guys find me out here? In other words, he was running away from church life, and the Methodist circuit riders found him. But you have to keep the church's head to keep moving. And the frontier experience will get heavily entwined with the Great Awakening. And you have groups like the Baptists and the Quakers. Now, the interesting thing about this, as we will discover, is that the first generation of Baptists in New England, by and large, did not like the Great Awakening. It was the First Baptist Church in Boston, for example, a minister despised Whitfield and the Great Awakening preachers. He thought, basically, if you can read between his mind, he's thinking, we're just getting respectable, and then these crazies come along. That's really what they were thinking. That's the attitude that they have. We Baptists are just getting to be respectable, and then when we got these other people, they're stirring up a hornet's nest again with all this talk about conversion and fiery hellfire and brimstone kind of preaching. They don't like it. But in the long term, we are going to see that Baptists are going to be some of the greatest recipients of converts out of the First Great Awakening, and especially as it flows into the Second Great Awakening. We also have attempts by the dominant churches to tighten up the situation. In other words, the churches are looking at this and saying, what are we going to do? And this will cause all kinds of disorder, disagreement, huge debates. I'm not trying to be alliterated here with lots of D's, but that's what they all came out as. I'm not an alliterative preacher, but that just came out as all D's. But anyway, they will see that this caused real tension among the churches. So we're going to have to look now at some of the regional situations that we have. Brief summary. The South had a weak Anglican establishment, but was economically dependent upon slave labor, and was always a somewhat tense situation. There's still this struggle that we talked about earlier. What do you do about bringing the Christian faith to the African slaves? New England was still under Puritan control outwardly, but was showing signs of weakness. The Anglicans were making some inroads. Baptist churches were beginning to have some small growth. There were little pockets here and there of non-congregationalists. You had the tension, say, between Mather and Stoddard over what to do about the halfway covenant, which was the dominant way that they were dealing with it, but they had now large numbers of people who were only halfway members of the church. Well, when some churches, like 80% of the church members would be halfway members. That's a weak situation. The middle colonies were pluralistic, but under a kind of generically Protestant banner. Now, I'll give you a couple of examples of this. In Connecticut, the ministers met in 1708 at the request of the colonial legislature to correct what it called the defects of the discipline of the churches. That's a direct quote. And what they did is they passed something called the Saybrook Platform. We're here, so you can see, called the Saybrook, Saybrook, the Saybrook Platform. And this was a church order which committed the Congregationalists to the Savoy Confession of Faith, which was really just a slightly modified Westminster Confession, similar to the Presbyterians, and adopted a semi-Presbyterian form of church government. And the New Hampshire and Massachusetts people never liked it. They always called it the creeping Presbyterianism down in Connecticut, because they had an association and they met regularly, and they tried to give oversight to the churches, and they were concerned about this decline. And they were trying to encourage things to try to stave that off. In the middle colonies, we have the denominational model of churches. what we would today call the denomination, because you had Presbyterians and Baptists, some Anglicans, Welsh Baptists, you had all the German groups, Dutch Reformed, and basically we're beginning to see that no church has a dominant model. In the South, we have a weak Anglican establishment, but they're trying to keep the dissenters out. Dissenter is the term for someone who's not an Anglican. But basically, the Anglican establishment is so thin that the backcountry is filled full of people, some of whom don't like organized Christianity, but especially don't like paying taxes for the Anglican establishment, but others who are hungry for some sort of spiritual life, some preaching. There was rumors of people traveling 40 miles regularly to hear preaching. But the Anglican establishment is doing nothing to reach them. Under these conditions, the Great Awakening would explode and would have the impact of reinvigorating the historic Protestant emphasis on salvation by grace through faith. It would reinvigorate the Puritan notion of an experienced conversion, but it would add a few new things. What would it add? If Puritan preaching was preaching to gain an experienced conversion, it was not necessarily fiery. What I mean by that is people have this idea of Puritan preachers as sort of hellfire and brimstone kind of preacher. That was not necessarily Puritan preaching. If you ever look at a Puritan sermon, it's long, as I've said before, and it's highly structured and literary. It starts with the text. And here are the doctrinal, here are the observations on the text. And they'll give you all of these exegetical observations. I mean, they would give stuff that today would be only reserved for seminary level, and they gave it to the ordinary people. For example, a pastor that I know, he always used to remind his congregation that the Westminster Shorter Catechism, some of you are familiar with that, that the Westminster Divine said it was written for infants and idiots. And they expected the kids to understand that. And most adults would look at that and say, ooh, that sounds like heavy theology. They expected 7-8-year-old kids. So it was heavy doctrinal preaching with lots of then uses, which were all your practical applications. Now, that included a press for conversion. What will happen is when we get to the Great Awakening is you'll start to get more of the stereotypical hellfire and brimstone fiery preacher. This will be first showing itself in the first Great Awakening. And you'll start to get the first preachers who have minimal education. And you'll get some really wild preachers. And you'll get some other interesting things. We'll save that for a little later in our discussion. We will also see that we get an interdenominational model. Because we're going to have George Whitefield, the famous Anglican evangelist, who is almost universally shunned by all the Anglican churches. They don't like him. He's crazy in their mind. Anglicans are for reasoned religion and decorum. And here's this preacher who's out there, you know, preaching these fiery sermons. And he was far more welcomed, especially in Baptist and Congregational and Presbyterian churches. And he preached lots out in the open air. You have Baptist preachers preaching in Presbyterian churches and Congregational preachers preaching in Presbyterian churches and interdenominational preaching, because it was a movement that ended up spanning a variety of these denominations. Denominations was just a few years earlier, and they still had their differences, and boy, the arguments were still there, but it tended to downplay some of those arguments between the denominations in favor of much more cooperation. But, as we will also see, it led to a lot of other splits. And those splits were over, do you like the awakening or do you not like the awakening? When you hear about what went on in the awakening, you will see why some did not like it. It was called great because it touched every colony and so much of colonial life. There wasn't a colony that wasn't touched by it. It led to a reinvigoration of many of the churches, helped several of the denominations have considerable growth, and yet, as we will see, it led to huge divisions. And it was the seedbed out of which the Methodist movement would grow. The Methodists are non-players in the First Great Awakening, basically. But many of the second generation of the converts of the First Great Awakening would end up as Methodists or Baptists. Those two groups scooped up, if you will, the biggest number of converts out of the First Great Awakening. Now, there were some precursors, but here I want to just show you, we'll get there. I want to show you here's George Whitefield, who is one of the key people. You notice he's cross-eyed. They always paint him that way because he was. Everybody said he was a handsome, slender man, but he was always cross-eyed. And all the painting, every painting you see of him, he's cross-eyed. George Whitefield, Englishman, who has been said may have been the best known Protestant in the whole world during the 18th century. Was educated at Oxford in the 1720s and 30s, and was a member of the Holy Club that the Wesleys were also a member of. Now, what was the Holy Club? Was a group of students that pledged themselves to godly living, to study of scripture, to fasting and praying. And sometimes it was pretty austere. They would fast for days on end, and they were very serious about this. Now, Whitefield seems to have had his what we would call his evangelical conversion while he was doing this earlier than the Wesleys, because the Wesleys came over to the Americas as high church Anglicans and tried to do mission work and failed miserably and went back with their tail between their legs. They were in Georgia. And it was later when they had contact, especially John Wesley had contact with the Moravians, that he had his evangelical conversion. He heard somebody reading Luther's preface to the Epistle to the Romans, and he said his heart was strangely warmed. But Whitefield, it's not quite as easy to date Whitefield's conversion, but Whitefield would prove to be the greatest preacher, not the greatest organizer, but the greatest preacher of itinerant evangelist of the Great Awakening. He first visited the U.S., what would become the U.S., the American colonies, in 1739 to help found an orphanage. And he returned later, shortly after that again, with a reputation as a dramatic preacher. There was a famous British Shakespearean actor who supposedly said he would give his right hand to be able to say the word Mesopotamia with the inflection that George Whitefield could say it. I mean, he was an incredibly dramatic preacher. He would do sermons in which he would act out the parts. He had seemed to have been interested in the theater as a young man. And there's actually a book by Harry Stout, the evangelical historian at Yale, on Whitefield called George Whitefield, the Divine Dramatist. And he argued that Whitefield never left his acting inclinations behind, and much of his preaching had a certain amount of drama in it, the way he did it. And he was incredibly effective. He itinerated throughout the colonies during the years 1739 and 1740, often drawing crowds of 8,000. This is, remember, pre any kind of amplification. And people could hear him. Can you imagine preaching to 8,000 people and everybody could hear him clear as a bell? He made several tours covering most of the major centers of population in the colonies, and he ended up dying on his last trip in the year 1770. And he's buried under the pulpit of the Newburyport Presbyterian Church in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Literally, he's buried under the pulpit. Some of his remains are not there because when in the French and Indian War, when the colonists from that area went off to fight, they took pieces of Whitefield's bones as sort of good luck charms, which I'm sure he might have just thought, what's going on here? But they opened up his casket and took pieces of his bones as good luck charms. So history shows you there are strange things that happen sometimes. Now, what was Whitefield like? He tended to preach on very limited themes. He was a Calvinist. He clearly believed in Calvinistic doctrine, which just puts to lie anybody who tells you that Calvinists cannot believe in evangelism. Probably the greatest evangelist of the 18th century was clearly a Calvinist. Believed in the doctrine of election, predestination, original sin. But he tended to preach on certain themes of the new birth. The new birth were favorite themes that he preached on. Have you experienced the new birth? His preaching, as I said, was dramatic. He remained friends with the Wesleys. He probably was more gracious to the Wesleys than the Wesleys were to him. I think Pastor Chris quoted his comment about how he said that John Wesley would be closer to the throne than he would be because he didn't think he would see him when he was in heaven. But John Wesley and his part, and in the debate over the discussion of sovereign grace, published a pamphlet called Predestination Calmly Considered in all capital letters, which gives you some idea of what John Wesley thought about the doctrine. And, even though Whitfield was gracious to Wesley, Wesley was less so to George Whitfield, but they were friends and shared pulpits sometimes. His genius was not in organization, but addressing ordinary people in plain, effective language. He could move people like very few preachers could. As I said, he had almost become an actor. He knew how to appeal to emotions. He also knew how to use the media to attract things. There was a man in the colonies who had discovered that it was good press to promote George Whitfield. So every time George Whitfield would be traveling, and he traveled, he had five major preaching tours and several minor preaching tours of the American colonies, this publicist would publish that he's coming. He would get handbills out. He would get articles in the newspaper. Whitfield is coming. And you have to remember, Whitfield would arrive. He would be there in his black clerical robes, and he would stand out there. He first tried to go to the local Anglican church, who almost inevitably thought he was a crazy enthusiast. By the way, this is a word that you will need to be aware of if you study this, enthusiast. Now, we use enthusiasm or enthusiast as someone who's excited. They meant by that a crackpot. That's what the non-evangelicals, especially the High Church Anglicans, thought described. That meant a crackpot. And Whitfield was an enthusiast in their mind. He preached these fiery sermons about new birth, about judgment, about the need to be born again. And they didn't like that. So he'd go to the local Anglican church, and almost invariably they'd tell him they didn't want him to preach there, even though he was an Anglican minister in good standing. So he would find anybody who could preach, anywhere he could preach. He preached in open fields. Sometimes he'd preach in a church, and people would be lined up. They'd open the windows, and there'd be hundreds and thousands of people around the church trying to listen to him. As I said, his appearance wasn't the key. As you say, he was cross-eyed. But he preached over 15,000 times during his 30-year period. Now, there's a famous thing in Benjamin Franklin's autobiography about whether Whitfield could be heard and how far he could go back. And he was trying to estimate what the crowd was when Whitfield preached in Philadelphia. He was convinced that Whitfield could be heard up to 30,000 people at one time. And Franklin did this by sort of doing a quick count of so many square feet of air and then backing up he was doing all this math in his mind while Whitfield's preaching. And it's interesting enough is that Franklin ended up being a good friend of Whitfield, even though Franklin was not a Christian at all. And they had numerous conversations together. Franklin had grown up in a Christian home, but he had rejected the faith. But he was curious to know about Whitfield's preaching, and he figured 30,000. But there's also a fascinating story in there that he said he knew Whitfield took a collection for the orphanage every time he preached. The orphanage was down in Georgia. And Franklin said, I was determined he was not going to get any of my money. And he said at the end of the sermon, he's doing his appeal for the orphanage. And I said, well, I emptied the copper coins, in other words, the pennies. And then he said, by the time Franklin was done, he'd emptied his whole pockets. So even Ben Franklin, who had decided he wasn't going to give a penny to Whitfield, emptied his pockets because of his persuasive oratorical ability. Lots of people were converted under Whitfield. But The problem that would arise is he was an itinerant. He came into a situation where there were established churches with of all sorts. It didn't matter whether it was New England, where there were congregational establishment, the southern colonies with an Anglican establishment, or church, the dominant church might be Presbyterian or Baptist. He was an outsider coming in. And this caused tensions with local pastors. Some of them welcomed him in, but others basically said, who is this English guy, an Anglican to boot, who is preaching and drawing these huge crowds? So every place Whitfield went, he had huge numbers of converts, but he always had opposition. The opposition would fester. Now the next figure we need to talk about, key figure, is Jonathan Edwards. That's a picture of him. He was the great, if Whitfield was the greatest preacher in the Great Awakening, Jonathan Edwards was its most famous apologist, who gave the theological rationale for the awakening when critics got pretty strong in denouncing it. His Faithful Narrative in 1737 was his first published work, and he defended the revival. Sinners in the Hands of the Angry God is probably his most famous work, yet it's probably the least typical of his preaching. If you've ever taken high school English class in your junior year, they still have it today, because I substitute teach occasionally in public schools, and it's still there. And all the students are just convinced this is what every Puritan or Great Awakening sermon was like. It was not. I mean, it's authentic Jonathan Edwards, but it's not what most of his preaching is like. You know, remember that story is where he talks, he has the image of God is holding you like a spider just by a thin thread over the gaping jaws of hell. And if you don't repent, this is your future. I mean, that's vivid language. Although Edwards himself, unlike Whitfield, who was an orator to end all orators, Edwards was not. Edwards, till the very end of his ministry, tended to read his sermons. He also tended to read them in a semi-monotone sort of voice, and when he could not look at his manuscript, he would look at the bell rope in the back of the church. So he would go back and forth between the manuscript and the bell rope, the manuscript and the bell rope. If you can imagine Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God being preached, being read from a manuscript while you look between the bell rope and the manuscript, the bell rope and the manuscript, and people were swooning and crying out as it was being preached. The power of Edwards was not in his oratory, it was in the content of what he said. It's in Religious Affections that he clearly lays out the arguments that it wasn't the intensity of the emotion, but the presence of a changed heart by grace, which was the most important sign of conversion. He, too, was a convinced Calvinist. He's also been considered to be America's greatest thinker. And I went to a conference once held at Wheaton College that brought intellectuals from all over the United States. There were people from every prestigious university in the United States on Jonathan Edwards and his theology. There were people who would get up and say, now, I'm an atheist, but man, I find this guy bright, and I love this reading this guy. You ought to read this guy, they would say. This guy is brilliant. Can you imagine an atheist intellectual historian getting up and saying Jonathan Edwards is brilliant? He turned his brilliance not only to defending the revival, but to defending the historic doctrines of the Puritan Calvinist tradition. It's been said that his doctrine of the Christian doctrine of original sin defended in his freedom of the will has never been answered by anybody of Arminian theological persuasion. Because what he does is tries to argue philosophically, and he was philosophically incredibly astute, that not only were the doctrines of Calvinism biblical, but they were philosophically the only ones that would pass ultimate muster. But so there are various sides to Jonathan Edwards. But he was also a theologian who was overwhelmed by a sense of the majesty and the glorious splendor of the divine. He was widely read in all of the intellectual currents of the day, And he was an interesting guy. He was a tall, straight-laced sort of man. By the way, he had 10 sisters who were all over 6 feet tall. And you can imagine, you know, his 10 sisters had two basketball teams. You know, he had 10 sisters over 6 feet tall. And he was well over 6 feet tall as well. He tended to be straight and ramrod. He would go out for an afternoon horseback ride. And every time he came back, he would have these little pieces of paper pinned all over his coat. Those are the thoughts he had while he was out riding. And he would come back after and would write them down in his notebooks. And he called them his miscellanies. And they are now finally editing all of those miscellanies in the Yale edition. Yale University had his manuscripts. A good friend of mine is one of the leading Jonathan Edwards scholars. We studied together at the university here, Jerry McDermott. He learned how to read it. He showed me some pictures of it, and it looks like chicken scratch to me. I can't possibly make any sense out of any of his handwriting, but he wrote these things down. People who study that, John Gerstner, who I mentioned earlier, was also a leading Edwards scholar. And they learned how to write it, read it. He has sermons, major treatises, and he's brilliant. But he was used starting in the 1730s, going through the 1740s, to be a major revival preacher. His sermon on Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God was not preached in his home church. It was preached in Enfield, Connecticut, where he was asked to come preach. As I said, he was not a screaming, fiery kind of preacher. Low key. But the Spirit of God was at work. People were convicted, and they literally screamed out for mercy to God as he delivered that sermon. These conversions were dramatic, many of them, during the First Great Awakening. He interacted with Locke, Isaac Newton, the New Scientific Thought, and used that to bolster his philosophical defenses of the revival, because the revival we're going to discover is going to be challenged. Some people thought it was enthusiasm, crazy stuff. Because there was a basic wing of it that was. A historian like Thomas Kidd has said that the Great Awakening and the response could be divided into three sectors. One sector are the opponents. We're going to talk just a second about the what the effect of it would be. Were the opponents of the Great Awakening, and there were many. They thought this preaching was enthusiasm, craziness. But there was also a radical fringe. Let me give you a few examples. There were preachers, and this happened in every branch of it, whether it's the Congregationalist, the Presbyterian, the Baptist churches, where they started preaching and rather quickly turned to denouncing unconverted ministers. From the pulpit, naming names and saying, Reverend so-and-so in our neighboring church is unconverted because he doesn't support the revival. And this, as you can imagine, caused no amount of furor. I mean, if Pastor Chris here would start preaching and saying, well, Reverend so-and-so over at our neighboring church, he's not converted. But they did. Gilbert Tennant first started it with his famous The Danger of an Unconverted Ministry, but it spread. This became part and parcel of a certain strand. An anti-intellectual strand came in, where they were denouncing all learning. The most famous one of this was James Davenport, who in New London, Connecticut, had a book burning, where they burned all kinds of works of Puritan theology, including some who everybody who knows Puritan knows they were absolutely pristine Orthodox Puritans. But he didn't think they were fiery enough. So he had a book burning. He also started burning what he called ostentatious clothing. He took his own pants off too and was going to burn those, and someone salvaged them because he had some plush breeches, and he took them off, and there's a I won't tell you the words that were used, but there's a famous comment that you can find that somebody had about his appearance after he took his pants off. And it, you let your imagination run with that if you want. But he was finally judged as to be mentally crazy and driven out of the colony. Now later on, interesting enough, he published a retraction and spent the last few years of his life as a Presbyterian minister down in New Jersey because he denounced all the crazy stuff he did earlier. But there was lots of this. There were services where people were rolling in the aisles, screaming. There were people who started getting visions. A common one were people who said they had visions of Christ. Another one were people who said they had visions of the Lamb's Book of Life and saw their name written in it. That was rather common. I saw a vision in heaven, and I saw the real Lamb's Book of Life, and I saw my name written, and I have assurance of my salvation now. Why? Because I saw my name in the Lamb's Book of Life. And the radicals took all of this at face value. Now, they would still say that I believe in the authority of Scripture, but they took all of this as legitimate signs, and they said that anybody who challenged these things was squelching the Spirit of God. So you can see, with that going on, why there might be some opposition to the Great Awakening. The moderates like Edwards, and Edwards and Whitfield were... Whitfield was a preacher who just preached and left and would always let the local ministers deal with the aftermath. He did. He would preach and leave and let the local preachers. Edwards was a local minister, and he had to deal with the aftermath. He wrote his famous book, two treatises on this, argued that this was a genuine work of God, but you can't judge the work either pro or con by these crazy stuff. In other words, the crazy stuff doesn't prove you're converted, but nor does it disprove that this is a genuine work of God. In other words, he was basically trying to say that the anti-revivalist and the radical revivalist were both wrong in what they were trying to do. The anti-revivalists were trying to say it proves this is all crazy enthusiasm because we have this crazy stuff. The radical revivalists were saying unless you have all of this and say it's all a work from God, you're against the revival. It got even more complicated because here's where we bring in the issues of missions to the Native Americans, missions to African Americans. Many of them proved to be rather open, especially African American slaves, to the preaching. And they started exhorting, just breaking out in the middle of sermons and exhorting people. So the services became incredibly chaotic. Anybody would just pop up and start exhorting people to repent and believe. And the ministers would try to stop it sometimes, and they couldn't, because it was wild chaos. Native Americans would be doing that as well. Women would start doing it, which many of the ministers argued against this was a violation of Paul's commands about the role of the women in the church. A lot of this was fomenting, and it led to churches that started splitting. Now, it brought huge additions to the churches. Some congregational churches said their membership increased four times during the time of the Great Awakening, which anybody who looks at this who's a serious Christian would have to say this is clearly the work of God going on in the midst of all of this. But you also have to recognize, while all this is going on, this really bizarre stuff is also going on. People yelling in the services and people rolling in the aisles. Some of you might say, well, doesn't this sort of sound like Pentecostalism? If you took out the tongue speaking, because until the 1790s, it looks, maybe there were a couple of stray cases of tongue speaking in the 1770s, but until the 1790s, there is virtually no record of tongue speaking. But everything else connected with modern Pentecostalism could be found in the Great Awakening. Virtually everything connected with modern Pentecost, prophesying, people would stand up and say they got a prophecy about this. God told them this, and it led to tensions because the churches would start splitting over this, especially when the revival would settle down, and then the question would come, well, are you squelching the revival? The Congregationalists split into what they called old lights and new lights. Old lights and new lights. Old lights, as you may guess, were against the revival. The new lights were for the revival. Now, interestingly enough, a significant number of the new lights became Baptists. There's a clear shift where people would go and become, because the what drove them to become new lights would lead them to the idea of that would be ideas that would be congenial to Baptist theology, postponing baptism until one had could testify to one's conversion. The old lights, some of them, had a tendency to drive straight into rationalistic Unitarianism. There were still traditional evangelical Congregationalists left, but their numbers were actually rather gutted by this. It's like the Congregational Church in Massachusetts kind of got splintered. The new lights, lots of them became Baptists. The old lights, lots of them became Unitarians and ended up denying the historic faith. Because if you were can you see the mindset? If this is craziness and you're emphasizing reasoned, rational approach to religion, along come the Unitarians. And, well, we really got the real rational approach to religion. All this stuff about the deity of Christ and the Trinity and original sin, that all sounds like theological mumbo jumbo to us. And they ended up in Unitarianism. Presbyterians and the Dutch Reformed experience splits. We'll come back to that in a minute. But they had injected an egalitarian, pietistic, emotional strand into those churches. The Presbyterian church split into what they call New Side and Old Side. The Dutch Reformed had their own distinct Dutch names for them. I won't worry. They called it, one's called the Cetus group and the other one the Verity group or something. They had these Dutch names for them. But same thing happened. Were you for it or were you against it? As I said, it did, though, encourage interdenominational cooperation. Now, what it would do as well, and we're going to just briefly, since we got started a little bit after 8, we can finish this up basically tonight and then take some questions, is in the South especially, it decimated the Anglican establishment. What I mean by that is this. The Anglican establishment was thin to start with. It tended to be these narrow, long parishes in Virginia along the river, 50 miles long and 5 miles wide, up and down these rivers. In the Carolinas, once you got away from the coastal cities like Charleston, it was there in theory, but in reality, they hardly touched anybody. What we will see is that, especially in the South, interesting enough, it wasn't congregational evangelists that came down. It was Baptist and Presbyterian evangelists. Especially since so many of these backcountry people were Scots-Irish anyway, the Presbyterians appealed to them, but also the Baptists would. And the Baptists and the Presbyterians scooped up, through the strong revivalistic preaching, huge numbers of converts in the backcountry. So that the Anglican establishments became just thin veneers in name only. In most of those areas. Now, technically, they were still supposed to pay taxes to support them. But what you will see, this will foment and will actually play a role in the American Revolution. Because especially when, as we will see next week, when their noise starts coming about them sending a bishop over, maybe bolstering the Anglican establishment, the Presbyterians and the Baptists and the Congregationalists especially disliked this, and they were fearful of it. It really played an important role. Let's look at it. Briefly here, at the Baptists as an example. The Great Awakening in New England led many to challenge the established church order. Remember, the Congregational Church is the established church. You pay taxes for it. The New Light Separatists, Congregationalists, a high percentage which moved on to become separate Baptists, as they called them, heavily revivalistic, did not like paying their taxes. Isaac Backus is a key example. He was converted during a revival. He first pastored a separatist congregational church, but then in 1767 became a Baptist. He became the most influential Baptist historian of colonial America, a vocal advocate of separation of church and state during the revolution, even though he also brought large kegs of beer to all his Baptist social gatherings. He was a very, very influential, convinced traditional Calvinist in every way, except that his views on baptism and church government were Baptist. He helped found a college in Rhode Island, which is today Brown University, because he began arguing that even though he was not college educated, the Baptists needed a college. The Baptists also developed very strongly in the South. Now, it's interesting, let me write his name up here. It was a Baptist, Shubal Stearns. Was a New England Baptist who traveled south along with his brother-in-law, Daniel Marshall. It's interesting. During this period, most of the revivalists started out in New England or the middle colonies and moved down the valleys into the southern backcountry. They founded the Sandy Creek Baptist Association, and they clearly described themselves as separate Baptists. They were strongly revival. Now, they also had some interesting characteristics. I'm just going to read you a few of these. These are some of the rituals that these separate Baptists practiced. Besides baptism by immersion and the Lord's Supper, they also practiced the love feast, a fellowship meal. They practiced the laying on of hands, foot washing, anointing the sick, the right hand of fellowship. That's listed as one of their rituals, that a church, to be a true church, you had to practice the right hand of fellowship. The kiss of charity. In other words, they practiced kissing each other in church. And they had devoting of children, which was something like an infant dedication service, I'm assuming, because I haven't ever been able to find much about this, but it gets listed in all of their those nine rituals. To be a genuine separate Baptist church, you had to practice those. They also, interestingly enough, tended to have female elders and deacons, a lot of female exhorters, which the more regular Baptists, those who were less separatistic called themselves regular Baptists. Eventually, these different strands of Baptists came together, and the experimentation that Shubal Stearns and Daniel Marshall did really petered out. But in the backcountry, as one person said, in Virginia, the backcountry was swarming. That's what with Baptist itinerant evangelists during this period. Swarming with them. That's a term that some of the documents say. And they had frequent clashes, of course, with some of the seaboard planters because there was a strong democratic element in this. Matter of fact, the famous Regulator in the 1760s movement was heavily driven by Baptist and Presbyterians who were chafing at the taxation and the control of the Carolina government by the rich planters, Anglican planters, on the seacoast with their fancy plantations driving around in their fancy carriages, sort of like an earlier version of Gone with the Wind kind of lifestyle. And they didn't like, the backwards people didn't like that. And they had tensions. So the First Great Awakening is having a huge impact in the backcountry. Now, the First Great Awakening, then, we'll finish with this, is our transition from Puritanism to what we would today call American evangelicalism. Here are a few characteristics of this. We'll finish with this. They tended to encourage a more individualized form of religion where sometimes denominational connections could be strongly contested, such as the separatist versus the non-separatist congregationalist, but also they could have cross-fertilization. Some of the results were a more empowered lay form of religion. Jonathan Edwards was dismissed by the fact that he tried to get rid of his grandfather's approach to the Lord's Supper as a converting ordinance, and he simply said you have to go back to the old original model of having a testimony of your conversion, and he got dismissed because many of these people were actually his cousins. They didn't like that. They fomented a revolt against him, and he got dismissed, although he stayed on, this literally happened, as a supply preacher for a year after they had booted him out. Can you imagine a preacher staying for a year in the pulpit after they had dismissed you? But he did. Then he went and ministered to the Indians. Revivalists such as Whitfield, it would be their style rather than their authority as ministers, their preaching ability that would give them authority. Traditionally, the minister had a certain authority just by virtue of his station. He was the ordained minister. Now people were looking for who has the powerful preaching style. We now have mass meetings for the first time. You were supposed to trust the godliness, the piety of the minister rather than his education or even his orthodoxy. After all, when you've had lots of preachers preach sermons and write pamphlets about unconverted ministers, you don't trust all ministers anymore. This had a huge impact on that. Some groups, such as slaves and Native Americans, were reached by Protestants in large numbers for the first time. David Brainerd preached to the Mohicans and the Delawares. Jonathan Edwards ended his preaching career with the Stockbridges, although even that didn't mean that the Indians wouldn't suffer from unscrupulous land speculators. They did. Some, such as Gilbert Tennant, Samuel Davies, and Whitfield, took special interest in preaching to black slaves. Davies wrote hymns geared toward black slaves. Didn't necessarily change the status quo of their social status, but many of the slaves resonated with the preaching of the Great Awakening. And it did would eventually cause some to challenge things such as the slave trade, and we can see direct connections between them. There was an intercolonial network for the first time, and some historians have even argued that this helped provide the seedbed by which the American Revolution, where they didn't see themselves as Virginians or Connecticut, I don't know how Connecticutians or whatever you, however you pronounce that, citizens of Connecticut, but citizens of the British colonies in America. The Church of England was a big-time loser, by and large, because they were primarily totally opposed to it. They were enthusiasts, crazies. Some have tried to trace notions of liberty, and you can make some connections, such as the new style of preaching, the downplaying of traditional privilege, and these would have long-term effects on American life. So we'll conclude with that tonight, and then next week we'll pick up a topic I know some of you are interested in, the churches in the American Revolution. We're going to spend some time on that next week. Okay, good. We have time for a few minutes here. So we have some questions here. Yeah. Most of the converts would stick, but the excitement would pass, which inevitably it's going to. I mean, you can't keep up that kind of excitement with that kind of preaching and people yelling out, even if you tried, unless you're going to artificially pump it up. That was the problem, is that some of the radical revivalists tried to keep it pumped up, and it becomes a law of diminishing returns. After a while, you can only keep it pumped up so long. But yeah, it's clearly. I'm convinced it was, as are most